I'm Derek Thompson, longtime writer with The Atlantic magazine on tech, culture, and politics. There is a lot of noise out there, and my goal is to cut through the headlines, loud tweets, and hot takes in my new podcast, Plain English. I'll talk to some of the smartest people I know to give you clear viewpoints and memorable takeaways. Plain English starts November 16th. Listen for free on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Jiffy Lube. Cars can be a big investment, so it's important to take care of them. I once got a car that I started out with 25,000 miles on. I got it to over 200,000 miles because I took care of it. You know how you take care of a car? You take care of the maintenance, the oil, the brakes, all that stuff. And if you don't, you can have a car just completely fall apart. When your car needs maintenance, head to Jiffy Lube. They provide automotive excellence at speed. Get your oil changed, brakes checked, tons of other multi-care services. It's all done by expertly trained technicians who actually care about taking care of you and your car. Jiffy Lube, car more. To find coupons and start an instant online estimate, visit JiffyLube.com.
There's no better feeling than a personal win. And the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
I need support staff to clear the room.
Stand up and walk now.
Hello and welcome to The Watch. My name is Chris Ryan. I am an editor at TheRinger.com, and joining me on the other line, emerging out of the Sarlacc pit of 2021, it's Andy Greenwald!
Chris, Happy New Year. You know, in a way, the Sarlacc is our role model because we're all back to outdoor dining.
That's right.
You know? And the pit of Sarlacc has made a meal of it, metaphorically and literally, for decades.
I don't digest Bounty Hunter well either.
It burns a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. Andy, it's so beautiful to see your face. We're joined again, as always, by Kaya McMullen. It's 2022, our centenary, you know, our centennial anniversary of doing this podcast. I don't think it's been that long.
That's 100 years.
Yeah, I know. Okay. Today we're going to talk a little bit about what we did over the holidays. Are we going to maybe get into some licorice pizza chat? I think maybe.
Are we? Feels dangerous.
Is this your new thing? Is you're not going to talk on this podcast? Then we're going to do some. We might do a little licorice pizza. We might do some Boba Fett, and we're definitely doing some Boba Fett, and we'll do a little bit of Station 11. So Andy, it's so great to see you. How you doing?
First of all, Chris, great to see you. You still got it, listeners. Chris has been on a journey.
He's been on a spiritual journey.
He has been balletically, almost matrixy, dancing through the viral bullets of the end of 2020. He's been traveling across the country. He's been dining indoors. He's just been having a great time. And Chris, you look great. You've really come out the other side of it.
I feel like the Federal Aviation Administration tried to stop me, but they couldn't. They couldn't keep me grounded.
Was that because you wouldn't wear a mask during a flight?
No, the flight out to Philadelphia was a like 4 hour plus delay.
Oh, I forgot about that.
And it turned into a backdoor red eye, which is just not something you want when you don't book a red eye, is for your flight to turn into a red eye. And shout out to the folks at Enterprise at the Philadelphia International Airport at 4:30 a.m.
Oh my God.
On Saturday morning. When I got there, they had to radio someone to come to rent a car because, like, I don't know where they were in the interim, but they were like, oh, hey, what's up? Like, I got a call saying, but I had to wait at the rental car place for somebody to show up. I got a Mitsubishi Mirage that barely made it back to my mother's house. And then, yeah, after that, it was really just like, it was bullet time, just avoiding these the viral loads.
I got to say, Chris, what's nice, and I don't know if all of our listeners realize this, but after midnight in December is when you want to be at the Philadelphia International Airport. You know what I mean? Like, that's when the most committed people, the civic pride is really, really there.
That's when the exchange of ideas is at its freshest.
Oh my God. Yeah, I know. It's like the cafe culture of Berlin in the period between the wars. And the weather, by the way, really recommends itself then as well.
Even though it was dark out, I could tell it was totally gray. You know,
yes. Like, oh, yeah. There was no color. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, so I went to Philly and then I went to New York City. Yeah.
And did you partake of culture during this time? Did you and mom check out anything?
You know, mom and I watched some movies. We watched some old classics. We watched Don't Look Up, which she enjoyed and I let her enjoy. We watched a couple of other things. And then yeah, when I went to New York, though, no theater for me this time.
Most of it was
shut down, though. They were taking some hiatuses.
Did you take a schwitz in the East Village? What are some
of
your favorite?
Yeah, I went to the Turkish baths.
Just picturing all your favorite things to do.
Fully nude except for the mask, you know?
Right. Well, no one said where you had to wear the mask.
I did walk by that place in the East Village, and I thought, I was like, mm-hmm. I wonder what the vibe is right now. I mean, do you think that they are outside of oversight by the city?
You mean like they got grandfathered in by a bunch of grandfathers?
Yeah, for people who don't know, there is a Russian bathhouse or a Turkish bathhouse that's on like 6th or 7th Street in the
I think it's Russian. I think Turkish baths are what Kareem Abdul-Jabbar talks about in Airplane. Maybe that's prison. I'm sorry. I'm mixing it up.
But yeah, it's a Russian bathhouse that let me say this. They didn't have a closed sign on, but okay. I didn't get the feeling like it was welcoming to any looky-loos or passerbys.
Yeah, I mean, look, we love to laugh and joke around. Obviously, things are pretty dire out there health-wise for sure. At the moment. But I hope it's also reflective of what might be kind of a shifting perception of this virus and its role in our life, that like people who hopefully everybody's gotten boosted, everybody's taking care of themselves and people are doing okay. And people want to live their lives. And that's kind of an interesting inflection point. I mean, I think that what is more powerful than COVID? Is it that horse medicine? No. Is it Spider-Man No Way Home? Yes. Like people yeah. ran a calculation and they were like, I want to see Spider-Man. And if the price of the ticket is $19.95 and the price of the popcorn is this, and it's also COVID, I will pay that price.
I saw Spider-Man while I was home. Yeah.
And I had a similar experience at, I know, one of your favorite places and many tourists' favorite places, the In-N-Out Burger by LAX, where people wanted their double-doubles and they wanted to approach this virus animal style. You know what I mean? Like, it was, we've reached the point, and I don't know, this isn't the platform for it. This isn't Derek Thompson's excellent podcast. This is not a place where you get, like, data journalism. But I have seen the most, like, yes, I have a mask and there's a string on the mask and that string is on my body,
mm-hmm.
but God damn you, I will not cover my breathing holes. Like that energy from in place, like not at like the Talladega Speedway, you know what I
sure.
mean? Like in places that I might otherwise expect to see people complying. So this is where we're at.
Like the in and out at LAX.
I would hope so. You know, that is generally a place where I think people from all walks of life and travelers and people leaving, people coming, they all come together there to get their burgers.
What about you? How is your break?
Oh, you know,
did you detoxify from all of like visual media? Did you triple down and catch up on stuff you'd missed?
Well, as you know, and as Kaya now knows, I am on week two of my news cleanse, my TL cleanse. I'm off Twitter. I'm off the news feeds. So again, everything I just said about the state of the world, pure hearsay.
Yeah, right.
based on like a couple like Instagram stories from people I follow because they make ramen. You know what I mean? So I could be wildly off. I watched some movies. I watched some 2021 releases. Some good, some not good. Did a little Criterion diving, caught up on some mainstream content that I missed, like Shang-Chi,
mm-hmm.
which was definitely a Marvel movie.
Sure.
I would definitely say that about it. And, you know, pretty much kept it light. It really rained a lot in Los Angeles. I don't know if people know that. That is a weird thing here when it happens.
I heard about
I know
that.
It's good.
I did not keep it light. I immersed myself in the Sheridan verse even deeper than I had already been.
Wow.
And I was already the guy who was like hanging out at the bottom of the pool with the scuba gear on. But I caught up on Mayor of Kingstown. So I'm up to date on that. That was like 4 or 5 hours. Well, here's the thing is I was going to watch Kingstown on the plane back to Los Angeles. And I had like iPad ready to go, and I had downloaded the episodes from Paramount Plus. And then the guy next to me started watching The Martian. Mm-hmm. And I was like, you know what? That looks pretty good. I'm going to watch The Martian too. So I watched The Martian instead, like 20 minutes behind the guy next to me. And then as The Martian ended for him, I was still going. He started watching the Jesse Eisenberg magic film, Now You See Me.
Oh, which one? There are two of those.
The first one, the OG.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know what? I haven't seen that since I was in the theaters. I think I'll watch Now You See Me. So this guy had me basically like I was just screen stalking him across the nation. Do you think that's weird? Would you get bothered by that, you think?
Yes. I think this is one of the weirdest things you've ever admitted to. The least the weirdest since you said that you hang out at the bottom of pools wearing scuba gear, waiting to be discovered by children who like drop their action figures.
It was a metaphor for my immersion in the Taylor Sheridan project.
A moment later, you were just shadow watching a dude's screen. Was he a TikTok influencer?
He was just like some guy. Also,
this is not good look for a podcaster. Like, your thing should be you come on the mic and you're like, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, here's what you should watch. You are so suggestible that on a delayed American Airlines flight, a man watching a magic movie from 8 years ago holds sway over you.
Let me tell you I was not the weird one in that aisle, because okay. The two people in my aisle did not stir for 6+ hours across the country. They sat, they watched their movies, they had 2 sips of soda. People can eat or drink as much as they want. The idea of not getting up to pee or stretch on a cross-country flight, that's Dahmer behavior to me.
Do you think they had like recirculatory suits that were like taking in some of their right. their liquids and just like pushing them back through?
Yeah. I don't know.
No?
I don't know.
So I'm going to ask the follow-up that our audience wants to know. Did you get caught?
He started watching the Matrix movie on his phone. So I don't know whether he was like, enough of this shit.
Did you start watching it on his phone too?
I was just like, this is a good part.
Did you guys just start high-fiving?
No. But then when I got home and over the last week, I watched like 4 or 5 episodes of Mayor of Kingstown, which I honestly think is like an amazing show. I don't know if it has any morally redeeming qualities. I would never ask you to watch it. I think you would be deeply, deeply offended by it. But is currently, this is not really a spoiler because it's set in and around the prison system. It's currently in a 2-episode arc of a prison riot, which will get concluded in the finale, which comes out Sunday. And I think it's just a really, really, really interesting show because it has the bones of like a CBS show, but it also has some elements of like Low Winter Sun era, like anti-hero TV, but also has like a pretty compelling, amazing central performance from Renner. Like it is definitely like almost probably as good as he's been since Hurt Locker.
So here's a question I have for you. And I apologize, like listeners, like I know that we are not fully covering the Sheridan verse in a way that those of you who partake are, it's not the way you're demanding. It's not what you want. Here's where we are. The question I have for you about it is, everybody knows that these shows are massively successful.
Yeah.
And 1883, the Yellowstone prequel, debuted
which,
to just
1883 is legitimately awesome. Like, I actually do want you to try and watch that.
I will. It has like mind-blowing numbers.
Lonesome Dove meets Sicario. It's really good.
Okay. You got me. You got me. You, to me, are like the random guy was to you. Like, I'm going to follow you a little bit behind, a little bit creepy. But the thing that I'm curious about, it, and I'll watch it, maybe we'll continue the conversation, is that the dialogue around the Sheridan shows now seems to be like sleepy, navel-gazing liberal Hollywood slowly waking up to these numbers and being like, huh? America like TV show? What?
Yeah.
And I feel like that's not really the story here because, first of all, everyone in America is watching TV all the time. So relax. Don't worry about it. But two, with the way you just described Kingstown, I worry that people are doing what I'm doing, which is to say, opining without watching the shows, but maybe taking the wrong lessons here, because it doesn't seem to me that these shows are particularly dumb in any way, or that these shows are particularly red state bait, that they are in fact a different kind of alchemy that is popular to a large number of people. And well, clearly a large number of people, not just in the middle of the country, but everywhere in the country.
So unbelievably, you've made it a season of television. Currently, like in the calendar year, Taylor Sheridan will have had 10 episodes of Yellowstone go up, which I don't like the last season of Yellowstone was not very good. I talk about it with Rosillo almost every week on the Prestige TV podcast. We'll do one tomorrow for the finale. I'll save my thoughts for then. He did 10 episodes of Mayor of Kingstown, and he'll have done 10 episodes of 1883 by the time this run is over. He also wrote and directed the Angelina Jolie movie, Those Who Wish Me Dead, and wrote the script for the Michael B. Jordan, Tom Clancy adaptation, Without Remorse. So I don't know where he finds the time. I don't know what his, how he does it. I was trying to come up with like a unified theory of the Sheridan verse, or a like what are his sort of like major preoccupations? And you can see some of them, but I think that the thing that I would stress to people is they're not all the same thing. Like, I think Yellowstone has different qualities than 1883. Kingstown has different qualities than both. Kingstown is very much, I don't know, it feels like on the continuum from like Oz and more like the Tom Fontana, David Simon school than it does, I don't know, like than it is some sort of like carceral state porn where it's just like it's dope to imprison people. It's not like that at all. And I think his political leanings, if you want to call them that, are a little bit more nuanced than they get credit for.
What do you think, if you could boil it down though, what is this, is the secret sauce that he doesn't hold back? And I mean that in terms of like pushing tons of plot, pushing tons of extremity in his storytelling. And that's very appealing because we've gotten a little bit reserved and thinky in our prestige television. Or is it more where we started, which is, yeah, like shit pops off on these shows. Plus they come out every week with a lot of people on them. You know what I mean? Like it is that reliability factor, which does matter.
So this will actually segue into the next thing I think we wanted to talk about, which was Boba Fett, which is that his shows do not feel safe. Like when you're watching them, it's not necessarily like, oh, anything could happen or some big twist or a character could die. It just feels like the scenarios that are playing out, the decisions that people make, I wouldn't in any way say that they are lifelike to me, but they do feel organically like almost operating without a net. And it does feel like almost anything could happen on these shows, and he doesn't make very safe choices. Now, some of them are satisfying on a primal level, and some of them might be a little bit barbaric, but they don't necessarily feel safe. Whereas, like, I think that, you know, we're used to watching a lot of TV that is made for a very mass audience, especially like the year we've had of talking about Marvel and Star Wars shows. And this isn't a shot at those things, but those are made for 7-year-olds and for 70-year-olds. Like, they want to appeal to everybody who has a passing interest in this stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think that, like, watching something like Boba Fett, one of the things that I kind of felt, at least in this first episode, which I thought was enjoyable in some ways, was just that, like, somehow this thing that I think that is a beloved character who people have thought about a lot for the decades, this feels like it's almost weirdly the safest execution of this. Like, it doesn't feel like there's anything surprising or challenging about it.
Yeah, well, I want to put a placeholder in, because what you're saying about feeling safe is why I love Station 11. Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk about the most recent episodes at the end of this pod. So we'll come back to that point. So with Boba Fett, I agree with you. I think that one thing to remember is that the idea of Boba Fett has always been so much more powerful and resonant and significant than the lived reality of Boba Fett. Boba Fett has been born aloft on the shoulders of an entire dorky generation, ours, who fell in love with the original Star Wars movies, had the action figures, and were just absolutely messianically drawn to the coolest looking character of all, who had almost no backstory and definitely no face. You could project anything onto Boba Fett, and by far the best action figure, because he looked like he could kick ass. Like, he had a rocket in his backpack, right? And a blaster. And you could easily use him in any kind of action figure game with any set of, he could be in the G.I. Joe verse. Now, don't get ideas, Hollywood. This is the problem with everything. But I'm literally talking about in 1984.
If you were just a basic, I watched the three movies guy, like Boba Fett, a little bit of a paper tiger. You know, like, kind of came out of the Midwest region with the one seed, but played not like a very competitive non-conference schedule, and then gets smoked the first time he actually has to fight somebody.
I feel like you're trying to say that Markelle Fultz is Boba Fett. and it's really bothering me. Like I that makes me sad. So yes, there's no way to satisfy that kind of decades long yearning for this coolness to be made manifest in some form. That said, I'm going to begin maybe from the different place, which is with the positives here.
Yeah.
Because
this is the new you, 2022 Andy.
That's right. And also, I should say, I have no idea if people like the show or not.
Negative for COVID, positive for positivity.
Let's hope. I know nothing about how the show's been received off Twitter. No idea. But I really...
I think the takes have been varied.
Okay. Well, okay. I really continue to admire what started as the Favreau-Filoni approach to this stuff, and now it's Robert Rodriguez, who's a really smart, inspired partner in crime for this show in particular and for this type of story, which is they really are going back to, in a way, spiritually, what inspired George Lucas in the first place, which is like the old adventure serials of when he was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that you will not find in either The Mandalorian or Boba Fett is big stars, which I think is kind of great. They feel really old-fashioned in the sense that you have these kind of aging gunslingers just messing around and moving as slow as they need to. And Temuera Morrison, 60-year-old New Zealander, scarred face, slow-moving corpus, you know? Like, there's a lot of Jonathan Banks and Breaking Bad energy coming off of him. Ming-Na Wen, who we've loved on TV and movies for years. By the way, 58 years young. Looks amazing. Jennifer Beals shows up in this episode.
She does.
It's the same kind of, we're just going to tell an old-fashioned story approach that really worked in Mandalorian. And, you know, it pretty much works here. The setup is a good one. It is, to your point, not particularly exciting or inspired because neither Boba nor we are young anymore. You know what I mean? So this is like, okay, so he's taken over a crime lord's throne and he's trying to, you know, do things a different way. We get it. This is an old story, but none of these stories have ever been new. I think the reason why I ultimately felt a little flat about it was because it is just such a, for as much as this is an old-fashioned story and a timeless story, it's such a profoundly 2020s story in that it is the best case scenario for something that is absolutely saddled with backstory and continuity and history. And, you know, Patton Oswalt and Parks and Rec really wanted to see the inside of the Sarlacc pit. I can't believe that we, who probably dreamed of this day, got to see the inside of a Sarlacc pit.
Yeah.
But the methodical...
Did it live up to your expectations? Did you think it was
going to... Oh, and more. You know, it was everything that I wanted. Combined my favorite aspects of the classic Dennis Quaid, Martin Short film Innerspace with the scene where Mr. Creosote bazooka barfs in Monty Python and the Meaning of Life. So All the cultural touchstones got touched.
Amazing. Combination of references there.
But you know what I mean? Just like the methodical climbing out. And then he has this thing with the what are they called? The Raiders? I forget.
Tuscan Raiders, yeah.
Yeah, and like, by the way, Tuscan Raiders.
That's
sounds
what
like
called,
Diane,
right?
Diane Lane and a crack squad of truffle hunters. You know what I mean? Take to the streets of Siena to exploit the best of central Italy. Okay. It just has to tell that story too, you know, and it feels kind of clunky to get there. There's nothing wrong with it. I think that people are probably tired of us saying this, and it's just we yearn for and will continue to yearn for stories that can stand on their own and merit being told. And there's no reason to suggest that this isn't going to pivot into something kind of interesting about
the jury is still sequestered on Boba Fett. But I think you're hitting an important point there, though, which is essentially that, like, this is an incredibly enigmatic character. And when you start exploring, when every sort of tertiary, secondary character in a popular story all of a sudden warrants their own deep dive, which traditionally in television shows, you would just do that within the show. Like, you know, if you really wanted to spend an episode with Saeed from Lost or something. Like, that was what was kind of revolutionary about Lost, was that like it should just be the Jack show, but instead it's everybody else's show too, right? Like, but in this sort of way we make things now, and it's like even seeing like there's like two or three Hawkeye spinoffs, and I like parts of Hawkeye. I don't know that I want to have like three shows about like three different characters from Hawkeye, but they kind of starts
Did they announce that?
I think there's an Echo show. Yeah, I would imagine there will be another Kate Bishop show.
Linda Cardellini, Life on the Farm. That's the show I'm going
like,
for. Yeah,
or like if they're rebooting Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., I don't know, but like it seems like they certainly are suggesting that. But my point was more just like, it takes away the art of the supporting character if every supporting character is actually just their own spinoff waiting to happen. And I do think that part of my like love of the first Star Wars movie was the brief moments where you see the Tusken Raiders or whatever, and then you are left to your own imagination to wonder about who and what these people are and what they're doing. And Boba was like the perfect example of that. It's like, what's this guy's deal? Who does he work for? Why doesn't he talk? All this stuff. And I know that there's been decades of cartoons and novelizations and everything that goes on to explain that, and there's stuff in the prequels that explains it. I'm just saying that, like, for me, I hope we don't lose the possibility of having like an unexplained mystery or an enigmatic character who's like briefly on screen or just kind of interacts with this world and then moves on.
We don't have that anymore. I mean, when I say that the Favreau and Rodriguez stuff was inspired, it is. I think that the most crucial point person is Filoni, right? Who is clearly a creative force to be reckoned with and has spent decades just, you know, dedicatedly farming this pretty arid soil left behind by George Lucas, right? Like finding all of the enigmatic things and all of the potential that was left dying on the vine in the prequels and just nurturing it. And from that got these series that, you know, that fans adore and friends and colleagues like Mallory and, you know, a lot of the Ringerverse people especially absolutely love. And it gets us characters like Ahsoka, who's getting a spinoff in this live action world as well. And that's the feeling that I get from these shows, that it's not upsetting. It's not bad. It's just, it's different, which is to say the side story is the story now.
Mm-hmm.
The side story is everything. The world, I mean, in retrospect, it seems insane that we lived in a time when the most culturally dominant property of our life was allowed to just sit fallow for almost two decades at a time because the person who created it didn't feel like doing it. I mean, how insane is that? And during that time, there were all these novels and comic books and then eventually these TV series and things, you know, all of which were wink, wink, not official, but some people came to love them as much as, if not more, as the main thing. And then, you know, starting with the sale to Disney and the sale of everything to Disney, like, it looks quaint. Now, honestly, it looks quaint. It's like growing up in black and white times when all this wasn't monetized and exploited. And frankly, exploited isn't the right word because it's being done beautifully. I mean, that's the other thing that I thought as I think when I watched The Mandalorian, like, is it just weird how easy it seems to do this now? I mean, the work they do on this fabled LED screen studio in Manhattan Beach is just stunning. I was rewatching some of the sequences of the show while watching it, like, when they're so Boba and Fennec get attacked in the town square, and then, then she chases after some of them, and they're jumping from rooftop of building to rooftop to building.
Yeah,
and
parkour, I'm like, coming back.
But I'm like, where? So how much of this was real? Like, where? Okay, so they built this building, and then they filmed it from three angles. And this is just pure Robert Rodriguez, right, who made a movie for $7,000 at the start of his career. Like, it's remarkable, and it looks beautiful, and it looks as good as anything that they've released as a Star Wars movie. And this is just what it is now, and they are servicing high quality content to people who love it. And maybe this is a way of saying, I'm not sure if we're going to be covering this show week to week. I haven't said that to you, but I don't know what, I'm not sure what there's to say about
it. I don't think people need us to be like, we're lukewarm on this for every week. I was just curious to get your thoughts about it. I was also really curious to see, like, this feels a little bit more like, first of all, I can't believe that like the Mandalorian house style has just become such a thing in such a short amount of time. I do think we are discounting that part of the reason why The Mandalorian was such a huge crossover hit literally was the fucking baby, you know, like that was like a hugely, whether, aside from the fact that it was memed to death, it was like people like my wife who was like, that's fucking cute.
Oh my God.
You know what you I should mean?
You, by the way, for people who think that I am jaded, during this break, my family and I were staying with friends. The friends weren't there. We were staying in their home. Well, they didn't know we were in their home, but we know where they keep the key.
Have you seen The Strangers? Yeah.
Max, don't listen to this part of the podcast. Anyway, it's not. Have you seen Funny Games? I think that's probably the better. Because I haven't. I just like to make a reference. So we're staying there, and there was not one, but two stuffed Baby Yodas.
Mm-hmm.
And my children, who have never seen The Mandalorian.
Or have they seen Star Wars?
The older one has seen Star Wars.
Okay.
Doesn't care too much about it, but has seen it. They both know who that is. They both know it's Baby Yoda. They both are completely enchanted. They love it. They think it's the greatest thing. So cute. So fun. My wife is like, this is insidious. Like, this is how they, this is like capitalism writ large.
You make it sound like you're married to Eileen Miles. Like,
your boy. Your boy was like, let me stop you there. I actually believe that this was a pure act of creation.
Mm-hmm.
Remember when season one of Mandalorian hit, Disney didn't have Baby Yoda toys in the chamber.
Yeah.
They did not plan for this. They did not realize what they had done. They didn't see it coming. I do think that it was, as cynical as it seems now, a pure idea of Favreau and kind of beautiful at that. And that's remarkable and amazing, and particularly at this moment. But I also think it comes back to something that be checking for.
Did you talk your wife into it? Was she like, I see your point. Great, great job. Now
Then she was like, I don't think that Bob Chapek can continue the unprecedented shareholder growth and return on investment as Bob Iger. And I was like, I can't argue with you there.
He's going to have to pivot to gambling.
You know? Exactly. The thing about Mandalorian, especially season one, is that it created a simple, back-of-the-napkin, compelling narrative reason for it to exist. This guy, this suit, we don't even really see his face, has to care for this cute baby. And that's the show. And then it allowed us to do all these other things until it ran, you know, face first into Luke Skywalker. And we'll see what happens after that. But this show has yet to make, in its first episode, it doesn't make that compelling point. It doesn't necessarily need to. It's a cool old guy doing old guy stuff, you know? That in and of itself is pretty neat. But it's fine. And maybe that's the benchmark for a lot of the stuff now. Seems fine.
We can take a break there, and when we come back, we'll discuss the episodes 6 and 7 of Station 11, and if you haven't seen those, we will be doing spoilers in those episodes.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Today Healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations of Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between, offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways Healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
This episode is brought to you by Etsy. Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Now until May 12th, get up to 30% off personalized jewelry, style, decor, and so many other items mom will love. And if you want her to know you put a ton of thought into her present, use Gift Mode. Gift Mode on Etsy takes the stress out of gifting so you can easily find well-crafted, original, and affordable pieces from small shops. Just tap or click Gift Mode on your Etsy app or Etsy.com. Then answer a few short questions about mom, and Gift Mode instantly gives you curated ideas based on hundreds of personas. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
Okay, man, we're back. We want to talk a little bit about Station 11, Episodes 6 and 7. So six is largely I guess year 20 Kirsten story of her wandering through the woods with Tyler, the prophet. And then episode seven is a flashback episode, or I guess a year zero story of young Kirsten in this Chicago apartment with Jeevan and Frank as they wait out the original, like the early days of the apocalypse, essentially.
Can I pick a place to start here? It's not spoilery for these two episodes yet. I do want to say I am on kind of a internet fast in a lot of ways, but I do occasionally check in with our Facebook group, the fans, the people, Voice of the Streets.
The only internet you get.
Yeah, and everything seems fine there too. Everybody just seems cheerful. I don't see what anyone's talking about. I gotta just make two blanket points. One, I think it's pretty great. The people are like, we don't know if we agree with Chris and Andy on this show. Mm-hmm. We are not here to rubber stamp your takes. You know what I mean? Like, this is awesome.
You like the pushback. Yeah.
I appreciate that. I hope it's being embraced and celebrated. And it's been interesting that some people are with us on the show and some people are on the fence. Some people have been, you know, feeling it more like a slow burn and some people are out on it. The thing that I have to say, because it bugs me, because I've seen it a bunch for years now. I wish we got HBO payola. I wish we did. I think that because HBO was an initial investor in The Ringer when it was a Bill Simmons media project or whatever, that people assume that Casey Bloys or John Stankey has a bat phone to us, and it would be a bat phone because of the Warner Media property.
That's right. Just respect the brand.
I think we are lucky that some people at HBO listen to our show, but no one has ever asked us to say anything about anything. I kind of could use the extra scratch this holiday season. I wish they had. But
you're
they
swimming in all this Baby Yoda stuffed animals you had to buy after the
trip. I had
to
buy so much. But no, there are no ulterior motives. We love this show and we continue to love the show. And I think that, you know, and I realize how funny this sounds I'm about to say, like, the show everyone thought we were going to pick as our number one is the HBO show Succession. It ultimately, and I don't want to speak for you, but what it came down to for me was something you were alluding to at the very beginning when you were talking about the Sheridan shows. Succession is so masterful, and it in many ways is just the zenith of every particular category of acting, of writing, of sumptuous production values, of execution over the course of a season. It's really hard to find a fault in it, and easily could make the case, and we probably did make the case week after week with our devoted pods to it, why it was the best show of the year. But Station 11 goes in such surprising, humanistic, unexpected, unsettling directions. Its ceiling is so... It doesn't have the ceiling, I guess is what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
Succession can surprise in the elegance with which it tells its story or plays its last card as it did in the finale, right? But there is nothing in Succession, and it's ridiculous, by the way, to say this, like as if I can't have a number one without denigrating number two. But for the sake of this argument, there is nothing that made me feel like I was leaving my body on Succession the way Frank suddenly rapping Tribe Called Quest in episode 7 of Station 11 did.
Sure.
That's not safe. That's borderline insane. And it was transcendent.
Do you think that's because that Excursions means a lot to you too? Do you think it's because in the face of something like total despair, you might have a moment of creativity and inspiration and love for the creative human spirit? Like, what do you think it was that you reacted to about that?
I think it's a number of things. I think that fundamentally, what I think this is what I'd like it to be, and I think this is at least partially true. I think that human beings, particularly human beings' emotional responses, are inexplicable and they are unpredictable and often jarring and shocking and not at all what anyone would have expected. And that is our lived experience with them. And I think that increasingly, not just because of the corporatization and synergy that we that is a part of our conversation about Boba Fett, but also just because of the margins, the amount of money it costs to make a show, the amount of money you could stand to lose if you have a chance to make a show, but if it doesn't work or if you're getting you're not listening to the notes, everything in the actual making of TV at this moment, or making of anything on a large scale, pushes you towards the explicable. Always. Always. Do we need to underline this? Do the audience going to understand this? Can they relate to it? Maybe we should just make it a little clearer with a flashback. Maybe we should just make sure that everyone understands everything on the screen at every moment, whether it's to fuel a future spinoff or just to make sure no one feels nervous and changes the channel here. That's what the machine is, you know? And so to go into it, there's an element of risk-taking in the storytelling of Station 11. And I'm not just saying this because we know Patrick, we're excited to welcome him onto the pod to talk about it later this month. But in that moment, that was the last thing I ever would have expected from the character of Frank or from the show. And, you know, it's a beautiful performance all across the board. And the performance is rooted in a kind of watchful, pensive stillness, right? Because it not only because it's getting colder, but because Frank seems to be understanding where this is going before anyone else does.
Mm-hmm.
So for him to just like erupt, everything about it screamed like this wasn't going to happen, right? Because even when he sits down, he's like, I've found something. And we're like, oh, well, we get it. He's losing his mind.
Right.
No, he's the only one not losing his mind in that moment, you know? I levitated when that happened. I was just so thrilled and delighted. And I was like, yeah, this is my number one. This is my number one because I want TV to make me feel like this, even if, and nothing can make me feel like this for 10 hours, but I want it to try.
If it had been me, I probably would have done Mobb Deep's Drop a Gem on him at that table. And I think it would have been a much different vibe, you know?
I think it would have, but I think you would have sold it equally well.
Thank you.
All, you know, you...
I agree with everything you're saying. I think that the thing that episode seven really made me think about was, it is not a unique story by any means. The sort of, post-apocalyptic road movie, the road story, the idea of people trying to survive under these extreme circumstances in the face of terrible odds, trying to persevere. There's something about what they've chosen to show and chosen to focus on that I love so much because, you know, even that those closing moments of the episode, which ends, I think partially because of the score, it ends on such like an almost optimistic or inspirational note, even though we've lost a character that we love so much in Frank.
And by the way, I didn't say the name Navon Rizwan. I don't know why I didn't. He's a genius. And people, maybe you realized before I did, he was the star of the pilot of Industry, a show we love. And this kid, he's only 25. Like this guy's a star.
He's awesome. And I don't know. I guess I'm trying to say that like, I feel like there are moments in Station 11 where you're like, yes, I could see that being in this show or this movie or this novel or whatever. But there's something that the specific people who made Station 11 are choosing to focus on. Mm-hmm. And there's a certain spirit that they're choosing to celebrate. And there's a certain honesty with which they're telling their story that feels unique to all of those stories. I don't know if I'm doing a good job of explaining myself. I guess I'm just thinking like, you know, you were talking about Succession, and I think a lot, we've discussed this before, but so much TV watching now is about answering a question, getting to a destination. And even though Station 11 is a limited series, even though we only have a couple of them left to talk about, I don't feel any rush to get somewhere. There's nothing I need to know that I didn't already find out from the show. I may, you know, more things may be revealed. I may learn something else about myself or about art or life or whatever in the last couple of episodes, but it's not about like this kind of false binary of like, will this or won't this happen? And if not, then what does this mean for X? It's like, this is just like this incredible portrait. You can feel the frame around the art, and I'm happy to be within the framework.
It's the frame. I'm glad you used that word. That's the word I was going to use too. That might be, I don't know if it's the hardest thing to do when you're making a show or adapting something, but in many ways, it's the most important decision you can make. And to your point, The frame here is so artfully done and it's so subtly done. I don't think that in episode 10, they're going to solve the virus. I don't think they're going to hit the reboot button on Chicago and bring it back. Nor do I think they're going to say like, oh, this is why the virus happened. The show has so skillfully steered us away from all that and unburdened itself from that. You know what I mean? I think in our quest to have so many questions to answer in the fiction that we enjoy, we forget that nothing, whether it's a 5-season show or it's a 10-episode show, can answer all of the questions. It doesn't work like that. And that, again, I'm sorry to keep beating up on it. It was a noble, I don't know if it was a failure, it was a noble attempt. But one of the reasons why The Last Man never took flight for me was because the frame was wrong. It was global. And it was trying to be macro and micro in a way that didn't really suit it. You know, we saw the world before, but then it seemed like a mystery why this thing happened. So we're going to solve the virus, but also solve society and also look backwards and forwards at the same time. No, I don't think that's possible. It's ambitious. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying they shouldn't try. But that was, there's something about the relative modesty of this show that I appreciate. And why I, frankly, I love the fact that it is, to a degree, Tiny Town. That everyone
the
was
seven
connected.
People in this show are connected to one another and also super important. Yeah.
Across timelines.
Yeah.
Because first of all, they're super important to our show, but they're not necessarily important to the fate of what's left of the United States or planet Earth or even the Great Lakes region. We don't know. It's just a couple people making a few people happy, right? It's such an important metaphor in the show that the internet's gone. The ability to communicate, you know, send photos, do all this stuff. No, the aperture just got a lot smaller in terms of what matters to be a human in the world. And the show doesn't really deviate from that. It kind of takes it as its own calling. And so you can take pleasure in these small little moments that, again, many people probably saw coming. But the revelation in episode 6 that the Museum of Civilization is the Severn City Airport.
Mm-hmm.
And so we know old Clark's coming. You know, and all those bills are coming due. Of course, that's what it is. None of this, they haven't traveled very far. And the beauty and the majesty of the show is that it goes from those opening scenes where people are flying across the world for logistics, right? To just leaving an apartment building becomes like the Odyssey.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's remarkably done. But I love what you said, because there are 3 episodes left. I haven't read the book.
I mean, in another show, we would be learning, we would get every step of Jeevan and Kirsten's journey. Mm-hmm. We would find out, like, the red bandanas would be marauding them. We would find out so much more about, like, whatever antagonists are out there. And instead, it seems to be about something a little bit left of center. And it's really inspiring.
So with all that said, because we love the show, it's our number one show, episode 6 was, I don't know if it was the weakest episode to date, because again, this is my favorite show of the year, but I'm curious your take on it. Do you find the specific circumstances of the Traveling Symphony in year 20 as compelling as the earlier stuff, as the breakdown of society, as the characters that we met then? I think that the most jarring thing of the show, and I look forward to talking to Patrick about how he tried to finesse this or manage it, is basically like, okay, so now it's this world. Remember, we're here again, and people carry knives, and anything stepping on glasses can be fatal.
I guess, you know, so that's an interesting question. I think that I'm probably more attracted to the Chicago stuff just because that obviously resembles a world closer to the one that we're living in right now.
And you love Touch and Go Records and math rock,
right. I think I've heard some people just kind of be like, oh, I don't really vibe with the Traveling Symphony stuff. Mm-hmm. It just feels a little bit deadheadish to me. I appreciate how specific it is and how it's like, what if this group of theater kids kind of found their own tribe together and were moving through the countryside? I never really stopped to ask the questions about like, how are they sustaining themselves? And you know, like all those sort of things that I think go into a lot of genre fiction where you start to like kind of need a lot of the world built up. I think that the way in which the show's moving kind of aligns it. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that of the all the different timelines and characters that we've encountered, I think that that's the one that I have the least connection to thus far. But you know, I think that it's hard to remember a show that has woven its timelines together so artfully and so well so that it doesn't feel isolated. You know, I think that maybe what I'm experiencing is unfamiliar because generally in a show like this, the present day, which in the case of the show, I guess is year 20, is the Traveling Symphony stuff, is the show. And everything else is the flashback to the show. And I think what Patrick and his collaborators are doing here is something a little bit more challenging, which is to say that all of this is the show. And all of this is the now and is the present and matters equally. And I think that probably the most brilliant demonstration of that was the bridge from 6 to 7. Mm-hmm. Because 6 ends with Kirsten
getting shot with
poisoned,
the start. Yeah.
Knocked out, and comes to talking to her younger self, dying from poison, apparently, and then relives as a spectator, as a audience member in the theater of the 80-day nightmare. Well, it's not always a nightmare. It certainly ends as one in Frank's apartment.
Right.
And I just thought that was, again, it's maybe it's more subtle or it's more structural than Frank rapping Tribe Called Quest over a chopped up homemade sample. But it was as fearless as that to me. It was a way to draw everything even closer together in a bow and make it all feel as important.
I wonder whether really or not, I mean, done. You and I, I'm waiting till I'm finished the show to read the book, but I wonder whether or not some of the Prophet Child Army stuff gets explained in the novel in a way that maybe it isn't in the show. I'm not sure though.
The thing that this is just pure me watching it. We can ask him about it. Kirsten goes to kill Tyler because Tyler sent children strapped with landmines into
and stole Alex. Yeah.
To potentially steal, tried to steal Alex, but then blew up Gil and blew up children to do it. I guess he says something, and I should rewatch it, but he says something along the lines of, like, I control the story, and when I was really hurt by you stabbing every part of me but my kidney, I lost control of the story and they kind of freelanced. I feel like he communicates something like that.
Right.
That's a pretty big, like, My bad, but not really my bad, you know, to stay alive. Now, look, I'm glad you didn't kill him. Daniel Zavato is giving a great performance, and he and Mackenzie Davis are really great together.
Yeah.
I really enjoy their anti-chemistry, but I think that part was a little more confusing than I would have liked. But ultimately, yeah, it's just, at the beginning of 6, I was like, am I bumping a little bit for the first time after being carried along just so effortlessly? And then it got weird and trippy again in a way that I was just, and then that's the airport, you know, and then they're in quarantine and they want to see their friends and you feel it, you know. Lori Petty's performance is so odd. It's so lived in and unexpected that you're completely invested in her and where she's going. And so much of this is casting.
It kind of goes back to what we were saying though, about like the Boba Fett stuff, where it's like you cast somebody and you have them create this fully lived in character. And then you only show that character for 1/8 of the time. And so that when they're on screen, you're like, I can't keep my eyes off this person. I can't take my eyes off this person. I can't stop thinking about them, but I don't need to know everything.
Or think about the fact that this show didn't have a traditional release, but it has been staggered, so people couldn't binge all of it. And Navon Rizwan as Frank and Himesh Patel as Jeevan. Two Brits, by the way. Mm-hmm. Jesus, stop. What, do we need to put in tariffs? Like, they're just better than us? It's embarrassing, honestly. Are so phenomenal with this quiet charisma in these parts, but we haven't seen them in a while. You know, the show just puts them on ice. And then all of a sudden you're so excited to have more time with them, you know, and to see what they're capable of. Chris, you've been to the East Coast more recently than I have. So maybe you can weigh in on this. How long is winter?
Chicago is a different beast though.
Yeah, I just feel like I gotta get the math because I believe the show starts
around
in December,
Christmas, right? Yeah,
yeah, and it's like so it's about to happen, but then it's just
like
Chicago
things in March and it's been cold as hell.
Okay, because they're like it's day 80, and it's like outside the only thing you can see is Jack London being like, "Oh, I got a good one for this." Like it is gnarly outside.
We can wrap it up there. Greenwald, we'll be back on Thursday, probably to talk a little bit more Station 11 as those next two episodes drop, I believe. And then, yeah, well, I'm sure we'll have other stuff to chat about. There's a bunch of stuff coming back in the next couple of weeks. Euphoria, Ozark, there's a bunch of things on the horizon. Righteous Gemstones.
I forgot. Wait, we can talk about it next time. We didn't really do the like movie roundup.
Yeah, let's do that on Thursday.
Because, guys, I saw a movie. It was so good. And it wasn't Spider-Man. I saw like the alpha and omega of the theatrical experience for me. I saw Spider-Man No Way Home. And a few days later, I saw Drive My Car. Both almost 3 hours. Both absolutely like just existential reasons to go to the movie theater. And I loved them both.
Yeah, so we'll cover some movies. We'll cover a bunch of stuff on Thursday. Thanks to Kai McMullen for producing. We're out.
We're out. Happy New Year, Baranskis. That's it. Chris just ends the show. It's over. Go home. The show's over.